Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Wednesday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking about that keynote report from the Office of the Ombudsman about the fact 1,300 people with disabilities under the age of 65 are living in nursing homes, often without their active or conscious consent or their choice. We'll hear from David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland, about a beautiful light show expected in the skies over Ireland tonight. It is the Trail Left Behind post Halley's Comet. And we'll be discussing how to staycation responsibly this summer with NUIG's Dr. Kevin Lynch. And we'll hear from Tamarin Nelson. She's a researcher and advisor for economic, social and cultural rights with Amnesty International. We'll be talking about the G7 summit in London and about the fact that in the majority of G7 countries, 70% of people living in them think their governments should force Big Pharma to share vaccine know-how. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at KFM Radio. A report released today by the Office of the Ombudsman entitled Wasted Lives details the experience of some of the 1,300 people who are under the age of 65 living with a disability in a nursing home. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Peter Tindall. He is the Ombudsman Information Commissioner and Commissioner for Environmental Information of Ireland. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
Some of the details contained in this report are shocking, and I know you conducted some 28 visits with people directly affected by some of the issues within the report. What sparked this investigation by your office?
We had a small number of complaints from people under 65 living in nursing homes, and when we looked at them, we realised that this was a systemic problem rather than a series of isolated incidents, and we therefore decided to begin a wider investigation to examine what the situation was and to see what needed to be done about it.
And in the general course of events, it seems that most of the people under 65 living with a disability in a nursing home have the capacity to live in their own homes within their communities, but they're in a nursing home because there's no support.
Yes. Some people could live with fairly minimal amounts of support. Other people would require more extensive support. But the reality is the rights of people with disabilities need to be respected, so that if they choose to live in the community in their own homes, then we ought to be finding ways to support them in order for them to do that.
One of the really concerning items to come through in your investigation, Peter, is that some of the younger people with disabilities said they did not give informed consent about being placed in nursing homes on a long-term basis. That has implications really for all of us.
Yes, people thought in some instances that they were only going for a temporary stay. People, for instance, might have had something like a catastrophic brain injury, and that they were forced to go into hospital, and they came into the nursing home expecting to be there for a short time until arrangements were made for them to return to live in the community, and many of them found themselves still there years and years later.
And it's that years and years. I heard, speaking elsewhere earlier today, a woman who had acquired a spinal cord injury had to spend 12 years living in a nursing home from her late 30s to her early 50s because there was no supported accommodation elsewhere. One of the people that you met during the course of your investigation said he'd wasted the best years of his life in an institution. It's very easy sometimes, Peter, when we encounter reports, to forget that these are individual people who want to live their lives in the best way they possibly can. And in this situation, they cannot do so.
That's exactly right. One of the things an ombudsman report can do is give a voice to people who aren't often heard. And we've tried very hard to do that. If people are interested, there's a video available on my website accompanying the report where you can hear the voices of some of the people we spoke to. Ultimately, these are people who, like you or me, want to work, they want to have friends, they want to have relationships and so on. Very difficult, as we heard, to do all of that in the context of a nursing home. They find their living routines are very rigid. They have to get up, eat and so on at particular times. That's not the way most of us would want to live.
You've issued a series of recommendations arising from your investigation. Peter, what are they?
Well, one of the first recommendations we've made is that a database be established to work out more information about these individuals, what their preferences are, what their needs would be if they want to return to the community. Now, that's been agreed to, and work on that is due to start soon. I'm also pleased to say one of the other things we're recommending is that moves be put in place to move people out. Well, government has agreed as a pilot program to move 18 people out. Now, with 1,300 people there in total, 18 is a small beginning, but it is a welcome one. So we're recommending that. There's a big problem at the moment in that there's a statutory financial support scheme for nursing homes, but there isn't a similar scheme for support to stay in your own home. So government have also agreed, as part of the program for government, to put a statutory home support scheme in place. At the moment, you can always access funding to go into a nursing home. It can be much harder to access funding to be supported in your own home.
Which, from a purely financial standpoint, Peter, seems to be counterintuitive, because surely it would be cheaper on the state to provide funding in many cases, but not all, for people to be able to accommodate themselves in their own home with a bit of additional support, rather than living permanently in a nursing home.
I think it's true for some people that it would cost the state less to support them at home. One person in the course of the investigation did succeed in moving out, and he gets 26 hours support a week. So that obviously would be cheaper than being in the nursing home. For other people, it might cost more. But if we're going to respect the rights of people with disabilities, then we have to be prepared to prioritise funding to ensure that they are able to live in the communities and that they are able to lead meaningful lives.
Are you hopeful, Peter, that having conducted this investigation, having issued your recommendations and heard the beginning of a pilot project, albeit a very small pilot project in the context of the overall cohort of people whose lives living in nursing homes you examined, are you hopeful that these situations may improve?
Well, you'd have to say guarded optimism would probably sum it up. I think we know that producing a report is the first step. It's important now that we work with the HSE, and they have, and the Department of Health, and they've both obviously are prepared to work with us to make sure that these recommendations are implemented, and that they're implemented over a reasonable time scale. I think we're coming up to a point now where decisions have to be made about financial priorities, and I would hope that this piece of work would lead to a greater prioritisation for funding to enable people to live their lives as they want to. And if I could just say as well, sadly, in the course of the production of the report, four of the people that we spoke to died, at least one of them from COVID, possibly more. And so there's an urgency for the people concerned about this. You know, they don't want to spend the rest of their lives in nursing homes. So it's important that we make sure that we tackle this with a degree of urgency.
Ombudsman Peter Tindall, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, there will be something of a show spectacular in the skies over Ireland tonight, and to tell us why it'll be there, joined on the line by David Moore. He's editor of Astronomy Ireland. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
This comes courtesy to us of Halley's Comet.
Yes, last meet of the sun in 1986, but its effect visits us every year around May the 5th, because we reckon it's been around the sun so many thousand times that it has shed dust every time, and it's spread out all around the comet's orbit. So every year when we get to this point in our orbit, where the comet's orbit is nearby, we plow through that dust and we get a meteor shower.
And is the effect that we will see in the skies tonight that of the more or less stardust hitting the Earth's atmosphere and then falling through?
Yeah, or comet dust. The Earth is made of the same stuff the comets are made of. We think there was a huge cloud of gas and dust. All the solid bits formed into the planets. A lot of this little more volatile stuff, including water, which may be where the water in our bodies and oceans came from. So it could be part comet juice, was left out in the outer solar system. And when these comets, dirty snowballs, fall in toward the sun heat boils them off. You get a big steam cloud surrounding them. Bits of dust fly off in all directions as well. And then the comet goes back into deep freeze. And that's what Halley's Comet has been doing. And we hit those particles at about 66 kilometers per second closing speed. So they burn up in a fiery streak. Just like if you rub your hands together very fast, they'll get hot too from the friction.
Now, the best time to see them will be after many people's bedtimes, but it might be worth staying up for them. It'll be after midnight, will it, David?
From Ireland, yes. This shower is best seen in the southern hemisphere, it has to be said. There's another shower associated with Halley's Comet in October, more on that then. In fact, there are two other great showers, even better than this one, that last all night in August and December. And the one tonight, you're going to have to wait till 3 a.m. until the direction the particles are coming from is above the horizon from Ireland. And then by about 4 a.m., it's starting to get bright. You'll notice a bit of a glow over in the eastern sky. So you've only got just over an hour to watch. So set the alarm. It's only 1 hour. You can go back to bed afterwards, and you might see a celestial fireworks display.
You'll also be, David, I would imagine, at an enormous advantage in the wee hours of tomorrow morning watching this show if you live in a rural area.
Yeah, you do see more away from street light than if you're under a suburban sky. And the reason is there are more faint meteors than there are bright ones. Now, people in the suburbs will still see the bright ones. There's still plenty to see. But those in rural locations get to see everything, as it were. Or if you're really enthusiastic, you could always drive out of the city. You're allowed to do that now and enjoy the spectacle. I've said it's only going to be for 1 hour this year, so it might be something special to do. And there are clear skies forecast. Temperatures could drop as low as -3, so do wrap up well. And if you've got a sun lounger, lie on that. Fill your field of vision with as much sky as possible so you can see any even on the edge of your vision.
Now, Halley's Comet, clearly, given this particular celestial occurrence, is the gift that keeps on giving to us. But when will we see the comet itself again?
Well, it last flew past Earth in 1986. The Europeans sent a spacecraft into the head of the comet. It wasn't NASA this time. And we read the photograph of the giant dirty snowball. It was 15 kilometres long, 8 kilometres wide. Tiny compared to the Earth, but the steam cloud is actually bigger than the Earth that it produces. That's why we can see it in the sky. But it won't be back till the year 2061. But don't worry too much about that. There was a much brighter comet last July. And I think a lot of people missed it. We were warning people about it in Astronomy Ireland magazine in the months running up to it. And then we published loads of photographs taken from Ireland of this comet that was as bright as the brightest stars in the sky. So don't wait for Halley's Comet. There's even one that might be good around Christmas this year, and another one that looking good for next year. And other comets can just appear almost unannounced, maybe a few months' notice. So
yeah.
If you find all this fascinating, join Astronomy Ireland. There's a fantastic online lecture happening about the Apollo missions next Monday, those two meteor showers later in the year. There's going to be a partial eclipse of the sun in just a few weeks in June. And there's always amazing things to see. The International Space Station's flying over. Go to astronomy.ie. Send us your counts if you do count any of these meteors tonight. And have a look at the magazine, see what you think.
Well, David Moore, editor of Astronomy Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Certainly a well chock-a-block calendar in terms of celestial events coming up over the next couple of months. But tonight's event, that will be the Eta Aquariid meteor shower, and will begin at around 3 o'clock in the morning. So now from next Monday, you can travel anywhere in Ireland that you may like, and very shortly thereafter, that off the top of my head, I think it's June 2nd, hotels, B&Bs and guest houses houses will open, one would imagine, camping sites and mobile home parks, etc. So the country may very well be very quickly on the move to holiday at home right across Ireland, but that brings with it its own problems or certainly things that we should consider. To discuss holidaying at home responsibly this summer, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Kevin Lynch. He's a lecturer in geography at NUI Galway. Kevin, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks very much for having me on.
We're delighted to do so. I suppose the first thing, and it may not seem like the first thing to consider, I don't know that I'd want to be living at the Dingle Peninsula this summer because everyone is going to descend on it. There are certain hot spots in Ireland where everybody is going to want to go. And you could, in the words of Robert Frost, seek to take the road less travelled by and go somewhere different.
Yeah, and I suppose that's one of the things that we're hoping people will do this summer. You know, last summer it was a case of it was all new and the staycation was new to a lot of people. And, you know, they headed for the same spots that traditionally people head to. But, you know, the last 10, 15 years, the Wild Atlantic Way especially has developed a lot, and there's a lot more to do and a lot more places to see, and a lot more places can facilitate, you know, big visitor numbers. So I suppose that's one of the messages we'd like people to get for staycation this year, to try and visit new places.
And another thing is really important, and it isn't necessarily the top thing that you would think about when going on holiday anywhere, because at some hazy future point we will be holidaying abroad as well, and this point applies as much at home as it does elsewhere, and that is be friendly with local people.
Oh yeah, you know, sometimes we forget we go on holidays and we think, oh, you know, it's time to unwind and we can forget about all our troubles and everybody is in holiday mode. And, you know, in some places that's kind of, they're set up for that, you know, and some places maybe in Spain that it's completely, the local economy is completely based on tourism. But in places in Ireland where we holiday, you know, there are local communities that have a whole range of different jobs and lifestyles, and you know, the tourism part of it is only one part of it. So very much if we can be conscious of that when we're visiting rural Ireland and you know, places around Ireland that you know, even I'm here in Galway City, although we have a big tourist influx every year, there are also people going about their daily lives. Mm. So, you know, they have to get up in the morning and go to work, and they need their night's sleep, and they need to be able to function during the day as well and enjoy their day too.
And Kevin, you live in Galway City. It is a tourist hotspot, but it may not, even at that, be prepared for the volume of people that could descend on it at any given time over the summer. So it might be set up for a certain number of people, but not the amount that will arrive.
Yeah, and you know, Galway City, you know, we'll kind of make do, and it really is set up for tourists. But some of the coastal areas and coastal communities, especially those ones at places where, you know, you might have a beach dune system or a nice forest or, you know, some other natural landscape like that. And they were struggling before this to accommodate the numbers, because our management plans for these areas aren't really good, you know, especially places like beaches, where right across Europe things like coastal zone management have been taken on board over the last 20 years or so, and we haven't really done a good job of that in Ireland. So we were struggling with this before COVID came along. Mm-hmm. And now with this new influx, it's just that added pressure that's really tipping us over the edge.
One of your other tips, Kevin, which is linked, is I suppose don't be an a-hole when you're going to new places. Be considerate of nature. We've seen, I don't know how many pictures of people, particularly in the finer weekends we've had in the last couple of weeks, going to visit a beauty spot within their county and leaving it looking like, you know, it was inhabited by Stig of the Dump.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the problems I think is that people, as well as, you know, not having connected with nature for the last while, and now, you know, there's lots of positive stories the way people are reconnecting with nature, but if they're going just to socialise, and people really needed that, getting out of lockdown to be able to see friends and things like that, that they needed to socialise. And then you throw in, you know, a bit of drink and whatever else that goes along with socialising, things can get out of control. So we really do need people to think about that, and think about the local people and the nature, and these things aren't there just for consuming. We have to leave them the way we found them, so that they're there for the local people and also other visitors that come along behind them.
Also, be cautious, and this isn't something necessarily that would spring to most people's minds, but if you're visiting, you know, a tourist hotspot, particularly one that might be only set up for a certain number of people or might be in a rural area, the roads that you're likely to be travelling down will probably be more Boreen-like than you might be used to if you live in an urban area. Car parking is going to be at a premium. People are going to get hot under the collar. So be patient and be cautious.
Yeah, and that's another reason to visit less travelled places, you know, just to spread that load out. The parking is a serious issue, because, you know, if you're going to affect the emergency services getting in, and with added numbers in all these places, the emergency services are being called on more often. So, you know, that is a really serious issue. And then the other part of it is, you know, lighting fires. It's just not a good idea, especially after a period of dry weather or whatever. These, you know, a wildfire can get out of control pretty quickly, and that's a very serious issue. You know, people live in these environments; their houses are in them, their livestock, their crops. We really have to be very careful about that side of things. And maybe one of the things I was saying in the article was maybe create that sociable environment in other ways. You know, make a fake campfire, bring some fairy lights, hang them on a little tree or whatever. You know, think of other ways of being sociable later in the evenings.
But even taking those really important points into consideration, Kevin, you should still explore. Take a little bit of Ernest Shackleton with you when you're going on holidays. Do those local biodiversity walks. Take that guided walking tour.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what makes the whole thing more interesting. And then you'll want to come back again, and you really value the local environment and the local culture a lot more. And then you can interact then with the local people a lot more. And, you know, it's positive all around if you take the time to do that bit of you know, education walks, or read the education boards or the local newspapers or whatever, and kind of immerse yourself a bit in the local communities.
Do you know where you'll be staycationing this year, Kevin?
we always head to Achill. We head to Achill every
year. Oh, it's beautiful.
And, yeah, it's an absolutely fabulous spot. So, and some of the stories that you come back with are even better. So the surf is great too, and it's always sunny in Achill.
Well, enjoy it. Dr. Kevin Lynch, a lecturer in geography at NUI Galway, thank you indeed for joining us. WhatsApp her in to us, 0833 97 97 97, and the WhatsApper says, Ciara, what about Irish B&B prices? Going online prices doubled last year. The government scheme failed. I don't, that stay and spend voucher scheme, I think it was hamstrung, A, by the fact it was very clunky to use, although I'm sure government and revenue would say otherwise. You need to download an app and scan in your receipts, and remember to keep your receipts in the first place, and then you could only spend up to, I think, €625, and you would get 125 back. But part of the problem with that scheme is it was only in operation for about 5 or 6 weeks, now my maths might be a bit off, before the whole country effectively went back into level 5 lockdown. So it never really got off the ground. But I absolutely take your point. I think anecdotally, anybody who's had a look at accommodation prices, certainly for later in the summer, might find them a little eye-watering. I would say that there are still bargains to be had, but I don't know how many people will be using that stay and spend scheme. Now, the G7 Summit of Nations is underway in London today. It's the first time that in two years that face-to-face talks have taken place between foreign ministers. In advance of and to coincide with this meeting, Amnesty International have conducted a survey of peoples in G7 nations about their attitudes towards Big Pharma in terms of sharing and making freely available information pertinent to COVID-19 vaccination. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Tamarin Nelson. She's a researcher and advisor for economic, social and cultural rights with Amnesty International. Tamarin, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to do so. I think Tamarin is joining us live from Brazil, so there might be a small delay on the line if everybody might be a little kind to us about that. Tamarin, this study shows what Amnesty has described as a supermajority, and I'm inclined to agree. On average, 7 in 10 people in any given G7 country think that their governments should force large pharmaceutical firms to share their COVID-19 vaccination knowledge and know-how. Why was this study conducted in the first instance?
Sure. So Amnesty International has been working with the People's Vaccine Alliance, which is a coalition of several different organizations working on ensuring that access to COVID-19 vaccines is available for the maximum number of people around the world. What we wanted to show is what the average citizen, what people actually think of the current situation around vaccine access. What we know so far is, at least as of April, the last numbers showed that in wealthy nations, about 1 in 4 people have had access to a vaccine, whereas in lower income countries, only 1 in about 500 people. So clearly there's an inequality. And a lot of this is driven by the fact that pharmaceutical companies who have been responsible for creating these vaccines have not been able to increase supply because there's just not enough capacity to reach the demand that we have. And part of the reason is that they hold on to intellectual property rights. So basically, it's, you know, the knowledge and the technology of how do you make these vaccines. So we wanted to get a sense of what do people actually think of that. In terms of companies holding on to those intellectual property rights, do people agree that those should be shared more broadly so that we can increase production? And what we found is that an average of 70% of people agree that knowledge should be shared, that technology should be shared with other manufacturers so that we can increase global supply.
Because a lot of what we've been hearing is effective hoarding, either hoarding of future supplies of vaccines or laying claim to them by an awful lot of the wealthier countries. Yes, I think that we can all acknowledge that the EU in particular has exported 113.5 million doses to countries between January and April. That is a drop in the ocean, though, Tamarin, of what's required, because I know your organisation and many others would say there's absolutely no point in leaving a single country or a single community out of the vaccination program.
That's exactly right. And I think what the survey also shows is that people know and they understand that this pandemic is not going to be over until it's over for everyone. You know, there's no way that we're going to be able to actually end COVID-19 until there is access to a vaccine to a broader number of people. And that it's important that everyone has a fair shot at getting that vaccine, no matter who they are, no matter where they live. And there's no other way around it. I mean, increasing supply is really the only way that we can do that. And what I think is interesting, you know, is that business as usual has not worked so far. We know that. We've seen that, you know, with the AIDS pandemic years ago, that when pharmaceutical companies hold on to their recipes, they hold on to their knowledge, to the technology of how they reach those vaccines, it doesn't work. And so we need a shift in that. And there are solutions on the table to make that happen.
What's being proposed to resolve those issues, Tamarin?
Yeah, so today's a big day. Like you mentioned, today there are several ministers, the G7 ministers are meeting. Part of the discussion, obviously, is around COVID-19 and vaccines. There is a discussion happening right now at the World Trade Organization around the waiver on patents around COVID-19 vaccines. This is a discussion that's been happening at the World Trade Organization for a while now.
Mm.
And, you know, it's obviously not a silver bullet. It's not going to immediately increase vaccine supply. But the longer we stall on that decision around that waiver, the more delayed vaccines are going to be in getting to the people who need it the most. And what the waiver would do is simply pave the way to lift restrictions around patents so that other companies around the world can start producing vaccines so that they have, you know, the knowledge and technology to actually do that, and we can actually increase supply. And then
because
another solution on the table.
The holding of patents, whilst clearly of commercial value and substantial commercial value to the companies that hold those patents, also creates a constraint on supply, because individual, Pfizer, for example, Moderna, Oxford, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, they only have so much facilities available to them. They are retaining the patents. Therefore, their production capacity is naturally constrained. So lifting the patents, would these, Tamarin, have to, these companies or whomsoever is approved in whatever region to supply COVID vaccines, would they have to agree on an individual basis to the lifting of that patent, or can they be compelled to do so?
Right, so it's a mixture of both. I mean, what the waiver would do is lift restrictions. Currently, right now, there are restrictions around what can be imposed in terms of patents. And so what it would do is it would lift that restriction, and then different countries and governments around the world could create their own regulations about how that would happen. So there actually are still quite a few steps here, which is why this is so urgent.
Mm.
And the faster we get to it, the more we'll be able to produce faster. But like you said, there's a constraint, but it's really an artificial constraint.
Mm.
I mean, the recipes are there, the knowledge is there, the technology exists. It's just a question of sharing it. And we are in the middle of a pandemic. And I think, you know, we've never seen the pandemic. What it's shown us is huge disparities and inequalities around the world. It's only magnified those. And I think we're in a moment where, you know, never have we seen it so starkly. You see countries that have access to vaccines, they have higher incomes, they're seeing a glimmer of hope, they're getting vaccines, they're coming out of the pandemic, lifting restrictions. And then on the other hand, we're seeing other countries that are just plunging right back into it, you know, seeing surges in cases that have actually never been seen before in the last year and a half. India, I think, is the perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lack of oxygen, lack of vaccines. You know, we're in a moment really where never has this been so critical, and the stark inequality is just very visible, and we need to take action on that. And both governments and pharmaceutical companies have the power to make that change. They can actually make that decision. They can. It's a question of making the decision and implementing the measures to make it happen. And so that's what we're asking for.
What's interesting, and it's a final and I suppose by the by point, but there is the quite a significant disparity of support among respondents to these surveys from all of the G7 nations in terms of their support for such a move in proportionate terms. The highest seems to be Italy at 82%, the lowest Japan at 58%. Now, ultimately, their governments will take individual decisions, and mm-hmm. to a greater or lesser degree, public opinion may or may not influence those decisions. But that's a huge disparity between countries in terms of approving that kind of action by government.
Yeah, I mean, Italy is a country that, you know, was the first one to suffer out of those countries to suffer the most stark impacts of COVID-19. So it's probably related to that. It's not surprising that people in Italy would be sympathetic towards the need of having a vaccine, and that people shouldn't be barred from having a vaccine just because of where they live or what their governments have been able to purchase. But there still is, I mean, even in the lower end countries, there still is quite strong support for this movement.
Mm.
So it's important for people to actually take action and make their voices heard so that we can actually have both governments and businesses, you know, actually taking every measure. And these are human rights obligations that they have. And governments have these obligations, companies have these responsibilities to make medicines, to make vaccines available to the maximum number of people around the world. And they have to take every step possible to make that happen.
Well, Tamarin Nelson, researcher and advisor for economic, social and cultural rights at Amnesty International, thank you indeed for joining us live there from Brazil.